Start. Hello, everybody. This is Matthew Aaron of The Matthew Aaron Show, www.thematthewaronshow.com. You can follow us on Twitter. I deleted my Twitter because I was in the process of selling something, a project, and I did not want them to read past tweets, so I have a new Twitter, at Matt Aaron Show. Sometimes I get so politically worked up that I spout too much on the Twitter, and I've decided to stop that. The Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook, and if you want to catch up on any of our previous 280-some podcasts, including our previous interview with Alan Loeb, where we talked about we're going to cover something very interesting that we talked about the first time that happened since then. But we talked about the dilemma, and we've talked about the change up and other movies that Alan, the Switch. I'm sorry, not the change, the Switch. Alan has done. We're going to talk about those as well. And we're also going to talk about what's going on in the business right now. But if you want to catch up on the previous podcast with Alan, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Hillary Barriford's joined me again. Hillary, hi.
Oh, again, yes.
and
my new part-time job, and I like it.
And my new neighbor right now is Alan Loeb, Highland Park's, Highland Park's fortunate son. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. How are you in times of pandemic time?
I'm all right. I noticed that you came back home for the quarantine. Did you just want to be around family right now, or was it in the plans to begin with? What brought you back home at the moment?
No, I did. I wanted to be in planning out kind of in a little bit of a. And a little bit of a rush figuring out as this, you know, kind of hit us quickly where I wanted to be and if I was going to be, you know, going under, isolating for a month, 6 weeks, 2 months, what would that be? Mm-hmm. I looked at my situation. I live in LA. I live in New York and LA.
Yeah, you're all over.
In New York, which was off. Yeah, New York was out of the question, as you could see. I was in LA. I was in L.A., and I couldn't go to New York, obviously. Population density, a city that was, we all knew New York was going to get hit hard, and it's getting hit hard right now, which is heartbreaking. So I was in L.A., but my L.A. place is small, and it's a loft, and it's in a building in Hollywood with a lot of people in the building, elevators, doormen, valet parkers, and I just didn't think it seemed safe to me in terms of trying to isolate in a building. Someone gets it in the building, who knows? People are going to freak out. I didn't know what, you know. So I didn't want to be in my L.A. place. I couldn't go to my New York place, so I was kind of trying to figure out what to do and decided to come back to the town I grew up in where my parents, who are currently, they're in their late 80s, but they're currently in Florida, where they go in the winter, but their place is open here. And so I came back here. So I'm in their place in the town I grew up in, but I am a block away from my sister and her husband and their kids. So that's who those are the only people I see,
well, that's
our family.
Well, that's good that you're not lonely. That's good you have people to see.
Yeah.
No, I see them. I see them and that's it. And, but it is kind of surreal coming back to the town I grew up in during a global pandemic.
I gotta be honest with you.
To come home.
I've been following your travels on Instagram, and I've been smiling the whole time because here you come home in the most unfortunate situation. But like Alan's doing the John Hughes tour, he's going to the Risky Business
nice.
House. He went to the home.
Yeah,
the home.
Like that. People
I loved
got
it.
A kick out of that.
I did.
I decided to go for walks. You know, and it's nice in the North Shore here of Chicago because you can go for a walk for 2 hours.
I'll
go for a walk. I won't see anyone, or when I do, it's easy to maintain distance. So it isn't a crowded area, and so I've been going for a lot of walks, and then I decided I'm going to go for walks by the famous movie homes in the area. And there are a lot of them. Risky Business, Home Alone, 16 candles.
Yeah.
And so I went by all the movie houses. I took a picture every day and then kind of wrote, did a write-up on each one and got a huge response. A lot of people like that. A lot of people texted me offline to say that they enjoyed that.
Oh, I thought it was great. You know, it's funny, Alan's gotten in a really good shape, and I think of Alan all the time about my walking every day, because when I can't go to the gym, I'm like, you know, I remember when Alan was doing like 10,000 steps a day, 20,000 steps a day, and I think of you, and it gets me to go walk. So congratulations on getting into shape and everything, and you inspired me to keep walking all the time.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Like
I am
that.
A huge walker. I'm actually walking right now.
Yeah,
I
might as well.
I do 15 to 20,000 steps a day, but I find it a way above and beyond just the, you know, being active physically. It's really where the writing and the creativity flows. So it's very hard to, for me, it's very hard to just sit at a computer and come up with everything. I got to get outside. I move. I listen to music. And that's where most of the inspiration comes from. And I just kind of jot it into my phone in shorthand. So actually sitting down at the computer and screenwriting for me is more of a downloading hour, 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
And the other three, four hours are actually walking around L.A. or New York, depending on where I'm at. And I'll just drive in L.A. I'll drive, I'll park, and I'll go for an hour walk. I just have these walks all over L.A.
And
out in New York, it's much easier. I just leave my apartment and just, you know, walk.
Right.
You know, wherever.
Do you do that thing writers do? Because I know I do it, especially in L.A. I think we know a bunch of writers in common who love going on walks, and they do their creative – they come up with their creative stuff on walks, and I know I do it. Do you, like, write it in your phone? Like, do you stop when you have a good idea and plug it in your phone?
That's all I do.
Yeah.
That's my whole life.
Me too.
Everything I do. And now I have in L.A., I have a writer's group. We're not all writers. There's a few writers and then a few, actually, a manager or two and an agent. It's a group of about 5-6 guys. And
yeah.
Every Friday morning at 7 a.m., we meet up and we do about an hour, 90-minute walk around West Hollywood as a group.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
We just talk. It's like a man's,
so
a
cool.
men's group. It's
no.
a men's group, and it's a walking group, and we've been doing it for about 2 years, a year and a half now when I'm in L.A., and it's a nice thing to do.
You can get a good walk in West Hollywood with all the hills and the, like, you can get a good walk in there.
Yeah, we meet up at, we always meet up at Alfred Coffee on Melrose, and then we kind of go around that area and we just talk. I do walks, you know, on the subject of walking. I do walks with various other friends around L.A. A great one, I think one of my favorites in L.A., just if we're talking, is doing the Silver Lake Reservoir.
Oh,
going around
wow.
the Silver Lake Reservoir is an awesome walk. Although now it's probably hard because there's a lot of people and then you have to socially distance. But when the world resumes to normal, you know, those types of things. And, of course, New York City, anywhere in New York is good walking.
Yeah, that's great.
I also recommend Beechwood Canyon, Alan. I live in Beechwood, yeah.
I got two staircases, hidden staircases there I do all the time.
Yes,
right there
the
that I'm sure you know about.
Gym. Oh, totally. I love the staircases. Are you kidding me? And there's nobody around.
Beechwood.
I've been going up to Lake Hollywood Park myself with my dog, and there's just nobody. It's great.
Beechwood is great walking, good hill walking, and great, good hidden staircases. Beechwood is definitely on my – like I said, in L.A., I've got about, I would say, 30, maybe 25, 30 walks in L.A. I just drive, I park, and I Beechwood is a staple. It's a staple in the list.
Mm.
Do you remember which walk produced which script or which story idea? Definitely a Melrose.
I do sometimes. I do remember some crucial ideas and where they occurred. I remember the walk I was on, and this was a long time ago. This was 20 years ago or maybe about 18 years ago. I was walking Santa Monica Canyon.
Wow.
There's the steps there, you know, those Santa Monica steps, and I was in that area.
Yeah.
And I was doing those steps and going down and doing that canyon in there, which is one of my favorite walks, a great walk. And that's where I came up with the idea of I really want to write my version, or I want to take a shot at what would be today's version of The Graduate. And that kind of led me down the path to a script that I wrote called Only Living Boy in New York, which subsequently got made into a movie on Amazon.
Yeah.
And I remember very specifically where that idea was born and others.
I love The Only Living Boy in New York. I emailed Alan about it. I finally caught up with it a couple months ago, and I emailed Alan, and I watched it. And, you know, I like Alan's work, and Alan and I keep in contact, and, you know, I like talking to him. So I figured I'm going to enjoy it, but it was above and beyond my expectations. And if you haven't seen The Only Living Boy in New York, you can see it on Amazon Prime, I believe. That's where I saw it. And it is a great, great movie. Mark Webb directed it. And Mark Webb, of course, fantastic director, did 500 Days of Summer, did The Amazing Spider-Man. I love Mark Webb. And The Only Living Boy in New York, you just have to see it. I didn't expect everything that happened in it. It was really, really good.
I need to add to thank you, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It is an Amazon movie, and I suppose that's a good transition to the concept of movies versus kind of theaters and streamers. And it was a good experience making it for Amazon. I enjoyed having it done through Amazon, and not actually for me personally. It was nice to not have to endure a release date and endure movie theaters and theater counts and tracking how many screens are we on and how much money do we have to do on the first 3 days of release. And if we don't do that number, then we fail. And if we do that number, then we're okay. And I've been through that a million times. And it's always, you know, unless you're the pretty, you know, unless it's a Marvel movie, most of the time you're going to fall short, most of the time. And, so Only Living Boy was nice. It was nice to just have something drop on Amazon, and then every now and then friends from college or old friends or like Matthew will text me and say, hey, I just caught that last night, and I dug it. And that's it. That's all you got. That's all you have to worry about. You don't have to worry about tracking or opening numbers or the whole all the metrics that have really taken over the theater release, you know?
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah.
And, I was thinking about the first time we talked and we met, you told me, I think, that it was that script that got you your agent at CAA, was it?
At the time, yeah.
Yeah,
that was a breakthrough script. For me, it was a game changer in terms of my career, that script. I was pretty much out of the business. When I wrote that, it was the last thing I was going to write, pretty much. It was what I called a Hail Mary project or a Hail Mary script. And it was the first thing I had ever written that got noticed by, you know, a lot of people and well-received by a lot of people. I had written a bunch of scripts that got well-received by one or two here or there, but just not enough to really forge a career. And that was kind of a completely different experience, that script. And it was... that year, it was a first ever Blacklist, Franklin Leonard's Blacklist, and that script was number 4 on the Blacklist, and did get a lot of notice, and got me my agents at CAA, and then got me in sold, and got me some good money, and then got me into every room in Hollywood.
Wow.
And there was, you know, a lot of love. And these are all people who I had known through producers or through other agents had passed on everything I had written. And they would say, where'd you come from? I'm like, dude, you've been passing on me for 8 years. Like, you have.
Wow.
You've read, not that it wasn't warranted. Maybe the scripts weren't for you, but you've read 9 of my scripts and you've passed on all 9.
Yeah.
Now,
I'm not saying
that, you know, that's your prerogative, but I've been here for years, and I've actually met you 9 times. And that was a game changer, that script. And then it took 8 years from, or I think maybe more, maybe 10 years from when it sold to Sony to when Amazon actually made it, it went through one of those really long circuitous roads to production.
Well,
I
remember you were telling me, you said to me, you're like, because I was really worried about, I just had representation that I fired, and I was telling Alan, I'm like, you know, I'm really worried about how am I going to get meetings, how am I going to do this, how am I going to do that, and Alan's like, just keep writing, it may, and then you told me the story about this script, and you're like, I haven't made it, but it got me this movie, this movie, and this movie, and then, but, and he said to me, he goes, I'm going to make that movie one day, and he did.
Yeah, it took a long time, and it had a lot of starts and stops. But it did get made. It got made at Amazon.
It got made very well.
And it never really released in movie theaters, and I didn't care. And now I don't. I talk to a lot of people in the business, filmmakers and actors, and I think now even more than ever, and it's been that way, coming this way for like the last 5-8 years. But now more than ever, I think most people I talk to don't care if their movie is released on Netflix or if it goes to 3,000 theaters. I guess some people still do, the people that are spoiled and the people that have been releasing huge hit. The Spielbergs of the world, have been releasing huge hit movies year after year for 20, 30 years. They might not understand it, although they get, like Martin Scorsese, who also has been, releasing great and hugely successful movies in movie theaters. They said to him, okay, well, you're going to do this for Netflix, but we're going to pay you like, a ridiculous amount of money, and we're not going to give you any notes.
Right.
And you can make it too long, which that movie was definitely too long, and you can do whatever you want, and we're just going to give you all the money in the world because you're Martin Scorsese. So they come around too in their own way, I suppose. So everybody, Ryan Reynolds is getting, $30 million a movie for Apple and
Jesus.
Netflix. And so they're overpaying some of them. And it is, but I personally have, I personally don't look at any sort of, don't see any difference in releasing a movie in a theater versus on a streamer.
No, I'm.
Well, Alan, I think it's interesting that when you sold that movie, Amazon wasn't really even a thing then, right? You sold it like 8 years before it was made.
I would buy books from them.
Yeah.
I would buy my book.
The biggest bookstore.
So it's interesting that like you could sell a script and not even know that the industry hasn't caught up yet with where it might end up or how it might come to the public,
I never would have guessed. Yeah, when I sold that script to Sony, if you would have told me, well, Sony's never going to make this movie, but that Amazon's going to make it, I would have been like, done.
What?
Because Amazon wasn't making movies, and Sony was. And now, Amazon makes a lot of movies, and Sony, not as many. I mean, when you look at the Paramounts and the Sonys and in the old-fashioned studios, they are still in business. But they are making a lot less. And now, I mean, I don't like getting to the current day and who knows what it's going to look like now in the age of Corona. And after this virus, is the theatrical business going to rebound, or how's it going to rebound? When's it going to rebound? I don't know if anyone knows.
Yeah, and if the studios are going to pay, if the studios are even going to pay that kind of money to make those kind of movies anymore, at least riskier films are not going to get made right away after this recession that may happen. We're talking about streamers and we're talking about the studios, and this is very interesting to me because Hillary and I just sold a project to Beacon Pictures in last October, November, and we don't have any representation, so we keep talking just to Beacon, and we kind of get the lay of the land of what's going on. But I think you would have a better idea. What is the difference between what the streamers are looking for and what cable companies and networks are looking for? Do you know, Alan?
I think more and more. Well, what do you mean the networks in terms of broadcast networks?
Well, I think broadcast is a totally different beast. But is there a difference between HBO and Netflix anymore? Is it just they're all trying to purchase content?
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of a difference, and they are trying to purchase content, but I think they all have their own brand a little bit. Netflix being, I would say, with HBO Max, which is not HBO.
Right.
I think HBO is trying to keep that patina, where most of what HBO is doing is just high quality, for lack of a better term, serial television. Succession, Game of Thrones just ended for them. But they're doing, you know, the Barry, they're doing a lot of good things. And
yeah.
Then they do a movie, it's the Chernobyls and those types of things. But HBO Max, from what I'm told, I haven't done a deal with them. But I am told they're going to do a lot more. They're the Netflix to HBO, and they probably will do all genres and all sizes. I think Netflix is the, you know, and it's a situation where now I think people are happy to be in business with them because they are going to make your movie. They're going to, a lot of movies, a friend of mine made a movie with them that he just wasn't going to get made at the studio system for many reasons. It just didn't have the audience the studio system needed. And Netflix gave him a budget and let him direct it and barely gave him a note.
Wow.
So people love that about Netflix. But the downside to the Netflix of, you know, which is everything, is you do get lost there, and you're going to make a movie there, and a lot of people aren't going to see it maybe, and you don't know. I mean, their movie star movies are still doing well. I think the Adam Sandler, Jennifer Aniston one did very well for them.
Sure.
I know that the Bird Box, the Sandy Bullock movie did very well. I'm not sure about the Ryan Reynolds, Michael Bay movie, if that did so great. It's hard to know with their metrics. But away from their movie star, big event movies for Netflix, they're still going to make a lot of movies and get movies made that otherwise wouldn't get made. But the downside to that to a lot of filmmakers is it really does come and go. A lot of them get lost in the shuffle. They have a lot. But in terms of HBO Max, I think, and Netflix are doing everything. I think Amazon does have a little bit of a brand, maybe a little bit more award. I think that's just because Jeff Bezos, and I think, you know, he likes award parties and getting awards personally, and so I think that over at Amazon they're trying to curry favor with Jeff by giving him projects like more award stuff. I think Apple has their own thing, which is I think a bit cleaner.
That's what we heard too.
Very edgy right now.
We heard the same thing.
They all have their own brand.
Yeah.
They all have their own brand, but there's a lot of players in the streamer world, and obviously Disney Plus is going to be more branded and family stuff. Disney stuff, and then you got the Marvel Universe and the Pixar and Lucasfilm and all their brands. So it's a huge marketplace. And the question really is now, away from the streamers, is going the other way. So, obviously HBO Max is putting a lot of money into this, and Netflix is always going to try to have a lot of production. But the real question here to ask is, what's Sony going to do? What's Lionsgate going to do? What's Paramount going to do?
Mm-hmm.
How many movies are they going to make? And I ask people, I ask my agents, I ask friends, I'm like, is Sony making movies? If I have a romantic comedy pitch, would Sony make it, buy it?
Yeah.
Like, and everybody's kind of scratching their head going, I don't know. I mean, they have people that work there. But I don't know if those people are actually greenlighting movies. I mean, you know, Sony, Sony has a tiny bit of Marvel left in them.
Yeah.
I think they own a few. They own the Spider-Man franchise.
And they got Ghostbusters. They got a couple IPs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but away from the IPs.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Paramount is still, you know, Paramount has the Mission Impossible movies, but away from the IP world and the branded world, my question is, let's say, Matt, you have a great romantic comedy idea that's like Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah, right.
Well, I would say, and you want to either sell it as a pitch or you write it as a spec, and it's a great script, and everyone thinks this is a great script, and you get some actors attached, and you might be able to get this movie made. My guess is 95 out of 100 times that movie's getting made on Netflix or HBO Max and not going to get made at Sony. And will not be released in theaters. And then the whole independent world. I have no idea how that's shaking out, but I know that the idea of, well, I've got this drama or this, you know, I've got whoever, Julianne Moore is attached to this very serious, dark drama. Okay, well, let's go to the markets and let's get $4 million to get this thing made from some really cool director who's really artistic, and let's do it that way and try to win some awards and get noticed. Is that even happening anymore? I don't even know how that's happening. I know that the independent film market has, over the last few years, been upended a little bit and has not been as vibrant as it was 10 years ago. And now with the virus and the economy, these things are all, we're all living in unknown right now. I do assume Netflix and streamers will be all systems go. And then one other thing to bring up to you guys, get your opinion on, is what just launched, Quibi just launched. And I don't know if
yesterday.
Quibi,
yeah.
Did they do well? How did it go for them?
Well,
do we know?
I don't think we're going to know for a bit because it's a 90-day free trial. So I'm assuming those numbers are going to be enhanced a bit until, you know, we could find out how many people are actually paying for Quibi. I can tell you this, like, I think anyone over a certain age that's not in California or New York, they're not downloading Quibi. I mean, I know my parents would
probably
have zero interest in it. None. You could put the best content ever on there. They wouldn't watch it.
Well, does
Quibi know that?
No, I mean, and the other thing
was just saying, did Quibi have that? Did they know that going in? Did they assume that going in, that our parents?
Well, what's funny is
it's
Katzenberg, and he's in that age group, so I'm assuming he would know. I'm also assuming he's like, oh, this is the way watching television and watching films is going in the 10-minute chunk direction. And we were talking to Mark Pellington yesterday, and I love Mark, and Mark said to me, he's like, don't watch my show until next week when all the episodes are released. Like, Mark didn't Mark's like, watch it like a movie. I don't know, but everyone I talk to is excited by it. Like, I know Joe Carnahan is super excited by Quibi. He thinks Quibi's the way of the future. I don't know if he's got a deal there or what that he says all that to me, but he thinks it's the way of the future. So, I mean, I don't know, but I'm skeptical, and I haven't seen a lot of Quibi talk on Facebook or Twitter. Like, zero.
Yeah. I have a problem. I do think that we do want them to do well.
Yeah, we do, of course.
As a creator, you want, they're another source to get your story told, even if it is in a unique or new form in the 10 chapter form. I have a project that's sitting dead, completely dead project at Lionsgate that Quibi wants to, that they are negotiations to get out of Lionsgate or to make with Lionsgate. However they do it in a unique way. And so now my project has gone from completely dead to maybe getting made.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe getting made, and that's through Quibi. That's through them loving the script and wanting to revive it. And anytime anybody with any money wants to revive a dead project, you got to love them for it.
Yeah, you don't say no. You are not saying no.
Yeah.
No, we want as many.
Yeah, exactly.
We want as many outlets as possible. I mean, we were excited before even Quibi at the market last year because Hillary and I were like, we got this project, we got this project, we got this project. There's no shortage of places to go. So that's the nice thing. But I'm curious to see, especially if this whole thing ends next month and we can all go back to work next month and I can go to L.A. and Alan can go back to New York and L.A., the market may not be much affected. But if this is like a multiple-month recession, I'm wondering if the networks and the studios are going to go with cheap and quick content or cheap and easy content, or if they'll go back to the former structure.
I don't know.
Definitely.
I don't know. I've been thinking, though, I've been thinking a little bit differently. My questioning has been, what stories are they going to want to tell after we just went through this? And my friend, one of my closest friends, wrote the movie Contagion.
Scott Burns.
Scott Burns.
Yeah.
Who is a very close friend of mine. And I was talking to him, and I said, I don't think you're going to, you know, be writing the sequel anytime soon. That's not the thing people need to see right now, because they're living it. And so disaster, dark stuff, kind of, you know, horror, you know, not that any genre will die, but I think there will be a return to a little bit more romantic comedy and hopefully light drama, drama, escapism.
Yeah.
And even a, even like a Frank Capra-esque type of uplifting genres.
Yeah.
I think that's what people are going to want hunger for.
I agree.
They tend to do that in tragedy. And so it's a question of, are they going to be making movies and greenlighting stories that genre-wise have been left for dead a little bit the last 10, 20 years?
Yeah, I think so. But then also you look, and disaster movies are the most popular trending movies on iTunes, on Amazon Prime. I mean, I agree with you. I think the direction things are going in is people want to see comeback stories and uplifting romantic comedies and Jimmy Stewart type movies and, you know, Tom Hanks type movies. I think that's what people are going to be really looking for. But then there's also, it seems, I mean, Contagion, as you saw, and you're really close with Scott, is one of the top trending movies in the world.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not the only one.
Well, I think that literally is, not that it's not a great movie, but I think people going into this wanted to be educated in the idea of what are we going through. And Scott did such incredible research. It's actually such a realistic, step-by-step version of what it's like to go through a pandemic. I think that was part of it too.
Yeah.
Is holy shit, what the fuck is this? And I hope I can swear on this.
No.
And then people, you know, saying, well, this movie pretty much lays out what we're living through, as almost a how-to guide. But yeah, I don't, we are living in such a time of the unknown right now on everything. I'm not sure how much they're going to make, what prices they're going to make a math, and genre-wise, it's just a guessing game.
Yeah, I'm guessing your best advice to writers and producers right now is just get as much material as you can ready for when this is over with, and whatever the market's calling for, you know, hopefully you got it. I know for Hillary and I, it's been important the last 2 years that we diversify. So we have movies all over that. We got sports movies, we got comedies, we got dramas,
horror,
right. So we're like all over the place. What would your advice be to everybody right now, Alan, about, what to have prepared and ready?
I would say I'll tell you what I'm doing personally. And my advice is always going to be the same. My advice is almost always the same, which is, you know, you want to follow, you're going to write best what you want to write, where your inspiration flows and where your bliss leads you and where your heart goes. And whatever that is probably going to be your best foot forward, regardless of genre. And that's always been my advice to everybody is write what you want to write. Write what you want to wake up every day and what story do you want to tell? Do you think you can tell the best and that you want to tell? I'll give you my personal manifestation of that through this is there's some work I have to do. There's some jobs I have to service that predated the pandemic. So I have work, which is great. And it's nice to, you know, make some money now in these uncertain times, as I'm sure anybody would agree. But above and beyond that, I have scheduled creatively time. I've created some time for myself to spec out. And the irony is I was kind of like, oh, I definitely want to spec something out. I don't know what it is, but, you know, I'm going to be underground now for a month or two and, you know, isolating literally. And I have a little space and time for something fresh. What should it be? And then I kind of went for some walks about a month ago, right in the beginning of this whole thing when I got back to Chicago. And ironically, what came to me and what I'm doing now and writing now, just for fun, it's literally who cares or knows if it goes anywhere. It doesn't really matter. It's about expression.
Mm-hmm.
It's not drama. It's not a disaster, drama, or sci-fi. It's none of that. The thing that kind of inspired me, so I'm leaning into, just because I want to have some fun, because it's, you know, these times you need fun, and I want to laugh, and I just... So I ended up writing, I'm currently writing a spec pilot, 30-minute spec pilot, that is just completely bombastic and fun and funny, and it's going to be born of the pandemic and have nothing to do with anything this pandemic represents. It's literally just kind of my version of having some fun during the pandemic. Whether or not that's what people want when we're done with this, and whether or not this script, you know, this pilot goes anywhere, it doesn't matter. It's just about me having that thing to write that gets me excited. And I think for everyone it's different. But ironically, I pretty much was, when I was thinking, what is that thing I should write during the pandemic? And my friends were all like, oh, you've got to write a script during the pandemic now, obviously. You've got to, like, do what you did with a Collateral Beauty, which is a spec I wrote, which was very emotional.
Yeah.
And they're like, you got to do that again. You have to find that beautiful kind of, we all going to cry story. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to look for it. I'm going to see if I get inspired. And that did not come to me. What came to me is this bombastic, insane pilot idea, which we'll see where it goes. But that's been a blast to write. And it's been an amazing escape. So I guess the answer, I guess that means, to me, what that is whatever inspires you and keeps, you know, and escapes you from this horrific time we're in right now, even for 20 minutes or an hour, 2 hours a day, when you're writing the dialogue and you realize you forgot that we were in a global pandemic and people were dying, that's what you should be writing.
I think that's
also the difference, though, between a seasoned writer who's been working in the business and someone who's newer, because I've been hearing from a lot of newer writers that are like, oh, I have this script, it's about a pandemic, or it's about the end of the world, it's perfect, I'm going to sell it right now. And Matt and I are listening to people going, what are they talking about? They have no clue. So I think, like, your approach is a seasoned writer understanding the business versus, like, someone coming in going, oh, I finally can get my zombie movie made,
why do I even want to read that right now? Don't send that to me. I mean, I'm not trying to be rude about it, but don't send that to me.
I'll turn on the TV. Who's a fresh writer is listening to Alan very closely, and hearing that it's not the time to be like, I finally can get my dark, shitty script made.
However, if there's a place for it, great. If there's a place for it, you know, I think what Alan's saying, and I agree with, is as a writer, it's hard to tell a writer to write. I've always been amazed that you can hire a writer and be like, I want you to write this story, and they're able to do it, because for me, I just am able to write whatever I won't feel like writing or whatever comes to me. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't pitch me a story really and be like, go write it. So I've always been impressed by that. So I think for most writers, they have to just kind of follow what they want to do and follow their creative path. Write their own thing. Like Alan said, he was looking for that, you know, that uplifting Jimmy Stewart, Frank Capra type, Collateral Beauty type movie.
Yeah.
And then it just turned into this, like,
what came is literally like a Larry Sanders show.
Yeah.
Like just very funny, ridiculous, very fun 30-minute digestible thing that I'm having a blast writing, and hopefully people will dig it, and maybe I'll make the show. Maybe I'll get the show made and I can run it. I don't know.
Hey, I hope it's Larry Sanders good, because that's one of my favorite shows ever. Peter Tolan actually is. Peter Tolan's a buddy of mine, and he's coming on tomorrow. We're going to talk tomorrow. And, of course, Larry Sanders
great.
Was
Peter
just...
Peter Tolan. Oh, I'm a huge fan of Peter Tolan. You know, he did, obviously, Larry Sanders was his, but I think he also worked... He was an actor and a creator of and did a lot of work on Dennis Leary's show Rescue Me.
Yep, Rescue Me,
one of my
and
favorite
the
TV shows of all time.
Mine too.
That's a Peter Cullen show, right?
Yes,
Peter
yes.
Was very involved
he
in that
created
show,
he created that and the Dennis Leary show The Job. And if you've seen Rescue
right.
Me,
great
the
television.
Yeah, so good.
Great television, right there. I mean, amazing. Rescue Me is in my top. You know, it's up there in terms of
yep.
me when people are always talking television and what's amazing. Obviously, you're going to talk about Breaking Bad and Sopranos and The Wire, and those names are always going to come up, and they should. And Game of Thrones, and they should. But I always
Deadwood.
Say,
yep,
Deadwood, yep. But I know David Milch. I always yep. say to people, I'm like, here's one you're not going to hear that you should check out: Rescue Me. It
yeah.
was so fucking good.
I agree,
it was so
and
good,
especially for when it came out. That was Dennis yes. and Peter's response to 9/11. Genius.
Yeah.
It was genius. Because they didn't treat it, it was not treated in any way you would have expected a 9/11 type show to be made. And then it wasn't a 9/11 type show at all at the end. But it always kind of had that soul to it. Yeah, Rescue Me is one of my favorites ever. I agree with you. I used to watch Rescue Me and Justified.
Yeah, Peter Cullen.
Yeah.
Well, tell Peter when you, he won't know who I am.
Yes, he will.
Just tell him when you see him tomorrow or talk to him tomorrow
yeah.
that you had me, you know, you had a writer on yesterday who is just a monster.
Well,
I'll
tell you what.
He is so good.
When this is all
yeah.
over, if you're in L.A. at the same time Peter and I are L.A., we'll do dinner. Because Peter and I go to dinner all the
that.
Time.
I would love that.
Yeah, you'd
I
have a great
that.
Time.
That
and
would be amazing.
Yeah, you two would be like besties because you have amazing stories. I mean, Peter's stories are next to none. He's just the best. I love him. I'm glad to see you're writing TV, too. I was going to ask you, do you have other TV
I'm
pilots?
I'm not sure anymore
you work?
If there's a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a difference anymore between movies and TVs besides the... I guess there is a difference narrative-wise. A movie can close and end in one storytelling, and it tends to be 2 hours. TV can be whatever. It's an ongoing thing. But what is, you know, what's I don't know if you saw Barry. Barry was
Yeah,
great.
I love Barry.
But
it's
like,
so
yeah,
good.
Barry was a, what was it? It was a, it was 30 minutes. There were 10, so 300 minutes. It was a 300-minute movie.
Yep.
That's what it was.
I agree.
10 chapters.
Yeah,
but it really was that first season. In what succession? I mean,
I love that.
The lines are, oh, of course. I mean, brilliant. God. The lines are getting crossed and blurred in such a pervasive way that it's really hard to say what's the difference between TV and movies. What's the difference between cable and streaming and all these things? It's storytelling. So I am doing, for lack of a better term, TV. I wrote a pilot this year for ABC. They did not pick it up, unfortunately, but it was a blast writing it. It was actually a broadcast one. I did it with Mark Webb producing,
nice.
And he was going to direct it because Mark and I are very close. But they didn't pick it up, unfortunately. But it was really fun writing it, and it was broadcast.
I agree.
Which is completely different than the HBO, and then, you know, people have said broadcast can be challenging, and it was challenging because the notes process and all of that can be tough. But you know what? I had so much fun writing it, and even though they didn't pick it up, that's life. But I'll do it. I'm doing everything and anything.
That's awesome.
As long as I wake up and I type on a keyboard and I go for walks and think about it, and what that thing is gets me excited. That's the only thing I really
care
about.
It's funny
anymore.
That you say this, though. I was just going to give it to you anyways, Hillary, because it's funny Alan says this, because the way we just sold our pilot to Beacon was Hillary called me up one day, and Katie Cooper, who's producing with them, and Hillary says to me, she goes, can you make this? It was originally a movie, and she goes, can you make this a pilot? And I thought about it, and I was really stubborn. I just wanted to make movies, and I'm like, I don't want to do TV. And then a week later, and a week later, I send it back to her, and she's like, great, what'd you change? And I go, well, I reread it and nothing, because the first 30 minutes is the pilot. And I'm like, oh, there's not a huge difference anymore between these two things. With TV and film.
No, it's all narrative.
Yeah.
It's whatever services the story.
to me, it's like, is your story worthy of 12 episodes, or is it an hour and a half?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. How long does it take you to tell the story? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this thing with Quibi that I may or may not be doing with Quibi, if they can get the right, I met with them and they were excited about it. They really loved the project, and it's a feature script at Lionsgate. Mm. And they said to me, so what we're going to, you know, once we get the rights, and hopefully we will, we're going to want to bring you on, and we're going to want you to quibify it, is the word they choose, which is turn it into 10 chapters,
yeah.
10 episodes of 10 minutes each. And I thought about it, and we talked about it, and I said, okay, no problem. I go, I kind of believe, like, I've never done anything like that. I have no idea what that looks like, but it doesn't sound that hard, because if I did my job, if any of us in feature writing, unless you're writing My Dinner with Andre, like if any of us are doing our job, we should around every 10 minutes want to fucking know what happens next. It shouldn't be too hard to say, okay, here's a good point for us to leave a cliffhanger. Maybe there's a little bit of writing and finessing to give that oops
sure.
cliffhanger feel and
yes.
come yeah. back. But it should organically be there. So any movie could be 10-minute episodes, pretty much. If the writer's done their job to begin with, it shouldn't be too hard to turn a two-hour story into 12 10-minute episodes with cliffhangers after every 10th minute.
I agree.
Natural within what we do for a living. Don't you think?
Yes, 1,000%. And I learned that, like I said, breaking down these movie scripts for TV scripts. I'm like, oh, we could do this as TV. We could do this. It's the same beats. It's the same narrative structure. It's the same. It's the same William Goldman way of writing, you know? I totally agree.
By the way, Matthew, 100%. You know, William Goldman was born and raised in Highland Park, Illinois.
I am
enduring a pandemic. Yes.
I've always been super jealous of Highland Park because it seems like everyone's successful out of there. Every successful person. Highland Park.
William Goldman talked about in, I think it was Adventures in Screen Trade, how the Highland Park movie theater at the time when he was growing up, which was a very long time ago, he recently died, it was called the Alcyon Movie Theater, and it was the one that I grew up going to movies in. It was called the Highland Park Movie Theater then, and now subsequently it's gone now. But the Highland Park Movie Theater used to be called the Alcyon Movie Theater. We're talking, and that's Alycon, and we are talking in 1955, maybe 1960, like in that time, or maybe even earlier, maybe even World War II, when he was 15 or 20 years old.
Oh my gosh.
And it was the Alcyon Movie Theater, and he wrote about how he loved the Alcyon Movie Theater, and him and his brother, who he wrote Princess Bride, the novel with, how he would go to the movies every weekend, and that's what got him started in movie and loving filmic narrative and becoming who he is, which is probably the greatest screenwriter of all time.
Yep.
And so Alcyon Movie Theater, and my first entertainment company when I first moved to L.A. in 1991, was called Alcyon Entertainment after that. Just a little bit of
that's so cool.
Named it after
I didn't
Goldman's
know that.
Favorite movie theater and the movie theater I grew up in too. Same movie theater. It's gone now. We both grew up in that movie theater, going to movies as 12-year-olds and 10-year-olds. And God, for Bill Goldman, it must have been in the when he was 10 or 12.
And I was going to say.
Been in the 40s. He died at 90 years old last year. So if he was 90 last year, doing the math, born in 1942, World War II, he was 12 years old, going to the Alcyon Movie Theater.
Wow.
Wow.
I knew that the Highland Park Movie Theater, I think, but didn't it just, it's not too long ago that it shut down, did it?
It shut down, and I'll tell you one more story at risk of boring you.
No,
guys,
you're not.
But it shut
come on, I love this stuff.
Down. It shut down, and my friend David Schwartz, who was a writing partner of mine in the 90s, and now he lives in Highland Park and in the real estate business, he called me, and he said, it shut down, but they're auctioning off pieces of the movie theater.
Yeah.
And I go, that's amazing. I'm going to buy some seats from the old
that's awesome.
Movie theater. You know, I'm going to buy. So I bought the seats, And then they called me after I bought them. I forgot what I paid. I bought them at auction. I don't think it was much, maybe a few hundred bucks. And they called me, and they're like, where do we send these to? And I said, what do you mean send these? I thought I had bought one seat. I guess I bought a full row.
Oh, my God.
Like 9 seats all attached to each other. And I'm like, can you unattach them? Because I live in a New York condo. I don't know how to do this.
I was going to say, like, you got the bachelor life.
They're like, it'll be very expensive to send these, and they're like, we can't take them apart. They're welded together.
Oh.
And I just said to the woman, I go, keep it. I go, just keep it. She's like, really? I'm like, take it home with you if you want it. I have no fucking idea how I'm getting these to New York.
Yeah.
And so I bought a row from the Highland Park Movie Theater, the Alcyon Theater. I bought a row of seats. And I never took delivery of them.
Oh, that's so funny.
Oh, my God.
The Tivoli's that way, too. I believe Classic Cinemas owned Highland Park Theater at one point. Highland Park Theater closed. I just looked it up in 2012. I knew it wasn't, like, too long ago. And because I've seen movies there.
Oh, my God, that was 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I bought that row. God, it's a long time ago. I thought that happened, like, 2 years ago in my mind.
No.
When you get really old like I am, that's what happens.
Well, they were demolishing it. They demolished it 2 years ago. They demolished it 2 years ago. So it may have been before they demolished it.
Okay.
But eight years ago it closed.
It may have been before they demolished it.
You know,
it felt like 3 years ago, this story I just told. Yeah. It happened 3 years ago. It was not 8 years ago.
Well, one of my favorite things about Chicago is the Landmark Cinemas. The Landmark is a company. They have a bunch of cinemas out here and Classic Cinemas, and they keep these old movie theaters. It's like the New Beverly, except even better to a degree, I would say. And that's no disrespect to Tarantino's New Beverly. It's great. But, like, they just have these great classic movie theaters out in Chicago. And, yeah, it's just the Landmark one, you go
on. I grew up.
Yeah.
I was just, not to interrupt. I'm sorry. I was just thinking out loud
because
you were saying this and intent bringing me down memory lane. And I haven't really had this conversation in probably 10 years with anyone.
Yeah.
I grew up. Obviously, the Highland Park Theater, but there was Eden.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember Eden.
Yes,
there
I do.
On Skokie Road.
Yep.
There was Eden's, and then there was Old Orchard.
Old Orchard.
Like the multiplex.
The mall.
In
Skokie. Yep.
Yeah, and Deerbrook had one, too. Deerbrook Mall had one. But Eden's was a standalone and classic old movie theater. The Eden's movie theater, they had two screens, and now they probably tore that down 15, 20 years ago. I don't even know. And it was on Eden's Expressway. That's where I grew up watching movies. It's the Highland Park Movie Theater, the Eden's Movie Theater. And I remember Raiders of the Lost Ark. I remember Clash of the Titans. I remember the movie 1984. I remember all sorts of movies when I was a kid going to those movie theaters.
Same. We had the classic cinemas, and my favorite, it's still around, is the Landmark on, and it's not a fancy theater. It's in a mall. It's like, why would this be your favorite? It's just because they play indie movies, and I've seen all my favorite movies there, whether it's David Gordon Green or Alexander Payne or Noah Baumbach. They play all the movies at Landmark on Clark Street, and I just love it.
I know that theater.
Yeah.
I know that theater. Who curates that, do you think? It's got to take a special kind of taste to curate that correctly and get those reels.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what I mean?
I don't know who's doing that over there. Someone really cares about the product over there. I know that.
New York, in L.A., you're going to get it all the time. L.A., you've got the New Beverly.
Yes.
You've got the Egyptian. You have the Arrow in Santa Monica.
Sure.
Where they have great old movies. But New York, they opened up this. My friend opened it up. His name's Alexander Olds, and he opened up what's called the Metro in New York. And it's a brand new movie theater, but it's got a classic feel to it. And he plays some really classic, not only classic old movies, but then he gets a little obscure, sometimes too obscure, I think. And he gets some really old, like, foreign movies, 70s movies from France, and like all this random shit like Tarantino would love.
Yeah,
no
right.
Would know what the fuck it is.
Right.
But that's at the Metro, and the Metro in New York is pretty fucking cool. And they do premieres at the Metro. They will do, like, if you have a cool movie, The Metro is a great place to premiere.
We did our premiere, and my movie played for a few weeks at the Music Box in Chicago, and that was a check mark.
Sure.
That was a check mark on my list as a filmmaker. I'm like, oh my God, my first film got distribution. It's playing at the Music Box for a couple of weeks, and then we had our premiere there, and it was just there's something magical about Chicago. And it's hard to leave. Everyone's like, why do you spend half your time in L.A., half your time in Chicago? And I'm guessing it's the same for you with L.A. and New York, where it's just like you leave New York and you're kind of waiting to go back after a couple weeks. You're like, boy, I kind of miss New York.
Yeah,
feel that way about Chicago.
I love Chicago, too, obviously, being a Chicago born and bred person.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of Chicago. But in terms of lifestyle, as I like to tell people when I talk about it, I love LA. I've got my best friends live in LA. My adult family lives in LA.
Yeah.
My brothers and sisters who I've been close with for years live in LA. So I'm not trying to shit on LA, but basically for me, it's about going to LA. Yeah. However, going to LA for me, I was doing the business, hustling the jobs, figuring out what I want to write, getting a few deals under my arm, and then going and actually doing the writing in New York, doing the walking in New York, getting on the subway, living the New York lifestyle in order to inspire me as a writer is kind of how I've been doing it the last 8 years, is I kind of generate the business in L.A. I do the dinners. I do the lunches. I have the fun. It's a fun town. It's sexy. Yes. It's glamorous. We all saw The Player.
Sure.
But then I go to New York to actually be a writer and just walk and be artistic and get and soak in that city. And God, that's what's killing me right now about this pandemic, is it's those things about New York, the subways and the crowded subways and the walking in the crowded streets and the population density, which has caused New Yorkers to be going through so much pain with this virus. And God, I hope it comes back. I hope New York comes back, and I know it will. It did after 9/11. It's such a resilient city.
I feel
but
the
God,
same
I
way.
I worry about that city. I really do.
I do, too. I worry about it, too, and I worry about Chicago. And, you know, I go on long walks every day in the city, and I can't do that right now. And it's not where I'm at in the city. It has the highest concentration of cases on the north side and the south side. But what I was going to say is LA, we all love going to Craig's and Dantana's and being there for a few weeks, but I get the least amount of writing done in LA, and Hillary knows this. I get all my writing done for the most part in Chicago. I get no actual creative work done in LA. It's all meetings and you know, it's creative to a degree, but I don't write as much as I'd like. Not in LA. It's difficult for me. You and I have the same attitude about it, and I do really miss the busy cities, and oh my God, this is making me feel lonely. We need to
miss you. Come back.
I thought I was antisocial before this. I'm like, holy cow, this is nothing.
I was not.
No, I worry about you every day. Hillary is literally at a premiere, at a party, at whatever. She is at an event every single night. And I'm like, oh, man, that's going to change.
It's been a rough change. It's been a rough adjustment.
That's good producing right there.
Yeah, she's great.
Being that a producer should do.
Is it ever, Alan? Yes. it's how we sold the show to Beacon. It's how I get everything done.
Socially. She's the one that's out there. I'm just trying to figure it all out, you know, from behind the computer.
I tell people when I speak to them, when I speak to, you know, film classes or whatnot, especially those who want to be producers or those who want to be on the business side more than the filmmaker side, I say there's nothing that can replace living in L.A., being social in L.A., and making kind of finding your tribe of friends and people in L.A.
Sure.
Relationships are really the cornerstone of this business, especially the business side of the business. And they you need to you pretty much, I think, to be a producer, you pretty much need to be in New York or LA, preferably LA, and you got to be an extrovert, I think, in this business.
Yeah.
And what I tell them all the time is let the writers be more of a socially awkward introvert. The producers and studio execs and agents, their job is to schmooze.
That's right.
And
I remember
it's still such a face-to-face business too. At the end of the day, I think all business in LA and New York is done face-to-face and personally and over dinners and over drinks. Like I don't see that changing, honestly.
Yeah. God, I hope not.
Well, that's what I was saying the last couple of weeks is, like, I could set up a bunch of meetings and network and, you know, I can get our stuff ready to take out, but I don't think we're going to sell anything till we can meet again, till we can see people again. I think it's going to be real difficult to sell something over Zoom.
Yeah, I agree. It's face to face. It's one of the few businesses that's still face to face, I think.
Well, hopefully we'll all be able to get face to face sooner than later.
Yeah. Well, you know, I really want to thank you, Alan, for taking out some time and doing this. I think talking about the business and talking about this pandemic for writers right now is really important, and I think a lot of writers will take your advice and take heed on it. So I want to thank you for that. I also want to, while everyone's listening to this Alan Loeb episode, a quick self-plug is you can watch Landline. Our last film is on Amazon Prime right now. It's on iTunes. It's on Tubi. It's on all these streaming sites. But if you need something to do, you want to check out a movie, check out my film Landline. Also, check out The Only Living Boy in New York on Amazon Prime as well. That's Alan's film with Mark Webb. That's just terrific. It's one of my favorites I've seen in a long time. I loved it. And yeah, Alan, I hope we get to do this again under better circumstances. And I hope I see you in L.A.
100%. Really, thank you for having me on. And Matt, let me know. Text me offline where and when I can hear this. And when you're going to drop this. And I'll have my friends and family all listen to it because it's good. It was a good conversation, and I really appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, Alan. You're the
best,
man.
Great talking to you, Alan.
Talk soon.
Absolutely. Nice to meet you, and
nice to meet you.
To you again, Matthew. Yes.
Thank you, Alan.
All right, guys, have a great pandemic, rest of the pandemic, and stay safe.
Thank you, sir. Cheers. Talk soon.
Bye.
All right, bye.